Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Jill Robbins, Alice Bryant, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, bread has now joined the list of goods in short supply in Zimbabwe. The lack of bread has caused its price to increase. Now, citizens are forced to look for replacements to this simple food source. Bread now costs $2 or higher, about twice as costly as the usual price. Many people are getting used to having their tea, a favorite morning drink of Zimbabweans, without bread. Gibson Nyema now sells goods such as sweet potatoes and corn in place of bread. He told VOA, "If we can get bread once a week, that will be it. But we no longer miss it because it is now expensive. If the government would push the price of bread and flour down, that would go well with our way of living. We have no cash. If it remains expensive, I will not be able to buy dinner if I buy bread." Food sellers like Nyema are doing well. But these are very hard times for those who mostly sell bread, like Alwyn Mutero. Mutero said, "There used to be lots of bread, but these days people no longer buy like they used to do, because prices are going high. We used to sell this bread for about $1. Now it costs about $2.50, so people cannot afford it." Mangaliso Ndolovu is Zimbabwe's Minister of Industry and Commerce. Recently, he said he found a company that could make bread using local ingredients to help ease the shortage and control the price. But farmers say they do not have a way to produce wheat that is cost-effective. They are calling on President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government to help. Ben Gilpin is with the Zimbabwe Commercial Farmers Union. He says that, among other things, farmers must have a fair price to cover their production costs. He adds that farmers must have the knowledge and tools to help the farming industry grow. Government and industry officials continue their search for an answer to the shortage. Meanwhile, Zimbabweans like Gibson Nyema keep thinking of other foods to take the place of something as simple as their daily bread.
Documenta is one of the most respected art events in the world. The art program is held every 5 years in Kassel, Germany. Recently, organizers chose a group of Indonesian artists to curate the next program. They asked Ruang Rupa, an Indonesian art collective, to serve as the show's artistic director. This is the first time Documenta has picked a group of people instead of an individual as its curator. The announcement has helped bring attention to Indonesia's lively yet struggling art scene. Documenta is now preparing for its 15th show, which will open in June 2022. The art program was launched in 1955 to crush support for Germany's Nazi Party after the end of World War II. In a statement, the committee said it chose Ruang Rupa for its ability to interest many communities. Ruang Rupa was founded in 2000. The group is known for making art in many forms, such as paintings and installations. The collective's work has been shown around the world, including art biennials in Singapore and Istanbul. The group also curated an art show in the Netherlands in 2016. At the last Documenta event, Ruang Rupa worked on part of a radio project called Every Time a Air Di Sound. The next event is called Documenta 15. Two Ruang Rupa members said in a statement, the show might explore things like new forms of education and the importance of art in social practice. Another member, Argus F.S., told VOA he hopes their curation will improve people's understanding of modern art. He added, Ruang Rupa is one of few art groups supporting art scenes in cities like Yogyakarta and Jakarta. Argus explained that many Indonesians do not understand modern art and said there are few art collectors in Jakarta.
He thinks the Indonesian government is not doing enough to help the country's contemporary art scene. Slamet Aji Pamungkas is with the Creative Economy Agency, a government organization in Indonesia. He told VOA that the agency has always supported the contemporary art scene. He said it offers guidance, improves performance spaces, and helps artists get the technology they need. Tubagus Andre Sukmana is a former head of the National Gallery of Indonesia. He now heads the Media Art Department at the Indonesian Ministry of Education and Culture. Sukmana told VOA that the ministry is ready to offer Ruang Rupa financing if the group requests it. Sukmana said the government has put together a plan that will support 10 cultural projects, including contemporary art. He said it also plans to give financial aid to artists outside major cities. The Indonesian contemporary art scene has grown in places like Jakarta, Yogyakarta, and Bandung in West Java. In a 2014 book, Yvonne Spielman describes Indonesia's art movements, such as the New Art Movement in the 1970s. It was born from protest against the narrow understanding of art at the nation's academies. Today, artists like Harry Dono and Handi Wirman Saputra have received attention both international and local. Handi Wirman has been chosen to represent Indonesia at the Venice Biennale in Italy in 2019. Argus says there are still issues for Indonesian artists, such as over-dependence on private museums to show their work. But, he said, Indonesia has the potential to be the leader of contemporary art in Southeast Asia. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Archaeologists have discovered about 200 Mayan artifacts in Mexico that appear to have been untouched for 1,000 years. The artifacts were found inside a cave in ruins of the ancient Mayan city of Chichen Itza on Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. Mexico's National Institute of Anthropology and History announced the discovery during a press conference in Mexico City. The lead researcher on the project is Mexican archaeologist Guillermo Dianda. He called the cave a scientific treasure. He said the artifacts appear to date back to around AD 1000. What we found there was incredible and completely untouched, he added. The findings included bone pieces and burnt offering materials. In addition, incense burners, vases, plates, and other objects were discovered. Some items included the likeness of Tlaloc, the rain god of central Mexico. The Mayans also had their own rain god called Choc. But experts believe the Mayans may have imported Tlaloc from other pre-Hispanic cultures. The cave where the objects were found is part of a cave system known as Balamku, or Jaguar God. The cave is about 3 kilometers east of the main pyramid of Kukulcan, which sits at the center of Chichen Itza. The stone city is described by the United Nations as one of the greatest Mayan centers of the Yucatan Peninsula. The cave sits about 24 meters underground, with areas connected by passages. Dianda said some of the passages were so narrow that researchers had to crawl in or pull themselves through. He added that his team had so far explored about 460 meters of the cave and is unsure how far it stretches. The team plans to continue exploring the cave. Artifacts found will not be removed but studied inside, he said. The team accidentally found the artifacts while exploring Chichen Itza in an effort to learn more about its underground water system. A series of sinkhole lakes, known as cenotes, can be seen on parts of the surface. But the archaeologists are exploring other water sites below pyramids, temples, and other buildings. Water was always central to the city. Its name in Maya means at the mouth of the well of the water wizards. The cave had been discovered by local people 50 years ago, but was not fully explored, Dianda said. He hopes the new discovery will help scientists better understand the history, lives, and beliefs of people who lived in Chichen Itza. He said archaeologists believe there may be another undiscovered cave hidden under the pyramid of Kukulcan that could be connected to the latest find. "Let's hope this leads us there," Dianda said. "This is part of the reason why we are entering these sites, to find a connection to the cenote under the Kukulcan." I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. America's 18th president, Ulysses Grant, was elected to his second term in 1872. Grant had led the Union Army of the North to victory over the Confederate Army of the South during the Civil War. He easily won the presidency in 1868 in the first election held after the war. Now he would spend four more years as President of the United States. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell about Grant's second term in office.
Grant's first administration was marked by dishonesty and shameful events. The situation grew much worse after he won a second term. Grant himself was not involved directly, but his administration suffered because of his ties to those who were involved. Soon after Grant's re-election, for example, there was a serious incident that involved many of his supporters in Congress. The Union Pacific Railroad Company had helped build a railroad across the American West to California. The cost of building the railroad was very high. The company got large amounts of aid from the government. Not all this aid came honestly. An investigation showed that leading members of Congress and even the vice president received shares of ownership in the company for free or at low cost. In exchange, they voted to use federal money to help build the railroad.
A few months later, members of Congress voted a pay raise for themselves and the executive branch of government. The pay raise would be retroactive. This meant the extra money would be paid for the 2 years already passed. Newspapers and citizens raised a storm of protest. Some lawmakers were afraid they would not be reelected, so they refused to accept the pay raise. Within 6 months, another shameful incident was uncovered. This one involved Jay Cook, one of the richest bankers in the country. He also was a good friend of President Grant. In 1869, Cook began raising money to build another railroad across America's West. He planned to sell $100 million worth of railroad bonds. Many people invested all the money they had in Cook's railroad, but Cook was unable to sell as many bonds as he expected. Soon, his banks had no money left. They could return no money to the thousands of people who had bought railroad bonds.
People hurried to other banks to withdraw their savings. Within hours, many of these other banks had to close. They, too, were out of money. Within a month, more than 5,000 banks across the country failed and closed their doors. This created an economic crisis. The New York Stock Exchange closed for 10 days. Factories closed. Thousands of people lost their jobs. Investigations showed that many of the banks that failed had violated banking laws. The laws often were not enforced because so many bankers had given money to the ruling Republican Party.
Other incidents followed. One of the biggest was called the Whiskey Ring. It involved a group of whiskey producers and some high officials who were friends of President Grant. Together, they found a way not to pay taxes on their whiskey. One of Grant's close advisors was at the center of the incident. A grand jury found him not guilty of any crime. However, it charged several hundred whiskey producers and government officials with illegal activities. President Grant had done nothing illegal, but the Whiskey Ring incident increased public feeling that there was no honesty in the White House. The feeling grew that Grant was a failure.
These incidents took place during a time of intense social and political change in the United States. The period after the Civil War was a time of industrial revolution and business growth. Most of this growth was taking place in the North. Before the Civil War, most businesses were small. Now, there were many companies with large numbers of workers. The companies also had large numbers of owners. They sold shares of ownership to anyone with enough money to buy.
A few men rose to positions of great power in business. In the steel industry, for example, there was Andrew Carnegie. He came to the United States as a boy from Scotland. He took a low-paying job in a factory that produced cotton cloth. He worked hard. In time, he earned enough money to take control of an iron factory. Carnegie soon built another factory. This one produced steel with a new technology. The system worked well. Soon, he was earning more than $1 million a year. He competed fiercely with other steel companies. He pressured railroads to transport his steel for lower prices than his competitors. And he cut his prices to force other steelmakers out of the business. Before long, Andrew Carnegie was the unquestioned leader of America's steel industry. His position gave him great power over the economy of the whole country.
What Carnegie did for the steel industry, John D. Rockefeller did for the oil industry. Oil became a useful product only in the middle of the 1800s. Rockefeller was part of a group of businessmen who built an oil processing center in Ohio. It was so successful that Rockefeller gave up his other business interests. He put all his money into oil production. He formed the Standard Oil Company of Ohio. John D. Rockefeller's new company used the same aggressive business methods as Andrew Carnegie. Rockefeller bought control of other oil processing companies. He started price wars that forced his competitors out of business. Most important, Rockefeller made a secret deal with the railroads. The deal greatly reduced his transportation costs. This permitted him to crush his competition. Before long, he controlled 95% of the oil processing industry in the United States.
As with steel and oil, America's railroads were an extremely important business in the 1800s. In fact, they were the nation's biggest business. They were as important as automobiles and airplanes are to the American economy today. Before the Civil War, most railroads were east of the Mississippi River. Most were small lines. In the years after the war, four major railroads got control of almost all the lines in the east, and they began building new lines in the west.
The first rail line to cross the nation was completed in 1869. It was built by two companies. One company started from the east and went west. The other went in the opposite direction. Finally, after 6 years of back-breaking labor, the two work teams met in northern Utah. They connected the rail lines with a golden spike. It was a great moment in the nation's history. Now, at last, the two coasts of the United States were united by a single line of metal rail. It was like the day 100 years later when the first American walked on the moon.
Like the steel and oil industries, the railroad industry also had its stories of intense business competition. In this case, the most influential man was Cornelius Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt already was rich from the shipping industry. Now, he formed the New York Central Railroad. It was the largest railroad in the East. Cornelius Vanderbilt tried to take over the railroad industry. He was not as successful as Andrew Carnegie with steel, or John D. Rockefeller with oil. A group of other rich railroad owners blocked his plans. But Vanderbilt did succeed in winning a great amount of power and influence.
Vanderbilt and the other new leaders of industry were powerful, and they let others know it. They sometimes made statements about how they did not have to obey the law. Other powerful men thought the same way. Some were officials, elected or appointed to serve in the federal government. Political power blinded them to their responsibility to be honest and fair to the public. As a result, the Republican Party lost public support. The blame was placed on Ulysses Grant.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.